Last year, Turkey went to the polls and voted back into office the strongman leader, President Erdogan. Less than a year later, Turkish voters returned to the polls, this time for local elections. A day after the vote, on April 1st, President Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters. 14-28 Mayıs
seçimlerindeki zaferimiz... 9 months after our victories on the 14th and 28th of May, unfortunately, we couldn't get the result we hoped and wanted at the local elections.
It was not a repeat performance for Erdogan.
Evelallah, dik duracağız, dikleşmeyeceğiz.
With God's help, we will stay upright, we will not be obstinate. For us, March 31st is not an ending, it's a turning point.
Bir dönüm noktasıdır.
On the day of the vote, March 31st, voters across the country rejected Erdogan and his party, the Justice and Development Party, or AKP. Instead, they gave their backing to the Republican People's Party, or CHP. The CHP re-elected mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, spoke on the night.
Sevgili İstanbullular, sevgili yurttaşlarım, siz bugün...
My fellow Istanbul citizens, you opened the door to a new future today. As of tomorrow, Turkey will be a different Turkey. You gave the opportunity to the first step for a Turkey where democracy, freedom, equality, rationality, and science, love, and solidarity will rise.
This week, we look at the recent elections in Turkey. How did Erdogan and the AKP lose? Who are the rising stars of the opposition? And what does this mean for the future of Turkey and Erdogan's presidency? My name is Hugo Goodrich, and you're listening to The New Arab Voice. The vote on March 31st wasn't a presidential election and didn't affect the makeup of the national parliament.
Well, last week's vote was supposed to be about municipal elections. People cast their votes and they were electing their mayors and local administrators.
This is Gönül Tol, the director of the Middle East Institute's Turkey program and the author of the new book, Erdogan's War, A Strongman's Struggle at Home and in Syria. While the vote at the end of March was technically local, in a sense, it was also national.
But actually, the vote on Sunday was more than that, because Erdogan had turned that into a referendum on his rule. He campaigned very hard ahead of the elections, and he personally targeted the opposition's most popular mayors who were running against Erdogan's hand-picked candidates, and at times he even threatened the voters that if they did not vote for his own candidate, that they would not receive services from the central government. So all those efforts turned the vote, the municipal elections, into a referendum on his rules.
This referendum on Erdogan's rule came down to a few key issues for voters. Perhaps chief among them was the country's economy.
Turkey's economy has been going through troubled times for some time. Last year, when the country held presidential and parliamentary elections, Turkey was struggling with double-digit inflation and growing economic problems.
So I think there's a lot of voters who are upset with President Erdogan's economic performance lately. Decided to punish him, including some Erdogan supporters, by not going to the ballot box. An economy specifically high inflation that at one point reached 80%.
This is Soner Çaptay. Soner is a senior fellow and director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The economy in Turkey is in a pretty sorry state and has been for a long time. For a number of years, Turkey's economic policy lacked independence and was often tied to political policy, with President Erdogan wielding significant executive powers following controversial changes to the constitution in 2017. What followed were years of economic unorthodoxy, which in turn led to blisteringly high inflation. Following the presidential election of last year, orthodoxy returned in the form of the newly appointed Minister of Finance, Mehmet Şimşek. Efforts have been made to get inflation under control. In January, the central bank raised interest rates to 45%, and on March 21st, just 10 days ahead of the recent election, they raised them again to 50%. These steps are having an effect, but not nearly enough of an effect to meaningfully impact the economic pain felt by Turkish citizens. One voting housewife in Istanbul was under no hesitation about who was to blame.
Erdogan should go. I mean, he really should just go. Price hikes for everything. What will our people do? I'm a mother of two children. What can we offer our children? Try buy a loaf of bread. See how much it costs? So, if we have to tell the truth, we need Erdogan to go away. Let's follow Kılıç the Rollers party. Let's see what they can offer. Maybe they'll be worse, but they look fine now.
Given how bad things have been in Turkey, and how bad they've been for so long, you may very well ask, why didn't they get rid of Erdogan 10 months ago, when they had the chance? Gonul again.
Despite the ripe socio-economic and political context, the opposition lost because they fielded, the opposition fielded a very uninspiring candidate. I think that was the number one problem. And the second problem was the country was going through these twin crises, almost economic crisis and the aftermath of the earthquake. So it was an incredibly stressful year for the country, where the society was looking at someone to address all those mounting problems. And the opposition at the time looked too chaotic. The opposition candidate was leading the six-party coalition, and they were the coalition was gripped by chaos and internal struggles. So I think that's why the opposition could have won the elections last year had they fielded the right candidate. So on Sunday, I think the victory that the opposition secured was not that surprising.
And Sona Çaptay.
Erdogan made a promise last year in May elections for parliament and presidency that he was going to turn the economy around. The electorate gave him a chance at that time. And this time, I think they basically said, you didn't keep your promise. And the punishment, of course, was the significant drop in turnout. Turks generally love to vote. Citizens in Turkey love to participate in democratic elections, which is a great tradition. Turnout can be near 90%. This time, it went down to almost 75, 76%.
At the start, we said Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party, or AKP, did not get the result they wanted. And the opposition Republican People's Party, or CHP, got exactly what they wanted. Or maybe more. So more specifically, what were the results? Well, it was certainly a CHP win. Across Turkey, there are 81 provinces. The CHP won control of 35, an increase of 14 from the previous vote. Included in those wins were Turkey's biggest cities, including Istanbul, Izmir, and the capital, Ankara. The AKP won control of 24 provinces, 15 less than the previous vote. Among the losses were a number of electoral strongholds for the party, including Bursa, Adıyaman, and Denizli. Some of the provinces lost on March 31st, the AKP had held for two decades. Additionally, the People's Equality and Democracy Party, or DEM, a pro-Kurdish political party, won 10 provinces, improving on their previous 8. Overall, the headline figure from the night is that across the country, President Erdogan's party, the AKP, won 35.49% of the vote, and the opposition CHP won 37.77% of the vote, a 2-point difference. It might not seem much, but represents a fundamental shift in Turkey.
No question that the biggest winner is the main opposition party, the People's Republican Party, that is long been considered as the secularist opposition to Erdogan, but the fact that the CHP managed to increase its votes and became the most popular party in the country, and that's a first since the party's heyday in 1977. So today, the main opposition CHP is more popular than the AKP in terms of the nationwide votes cast for the parties.
Not only did CHP win big cities, kept Istanbul, Ankara and Izmir, and won a couple of other big cities such as Bursa and others, but it also make inroads into the Anatolian hinterland. You know, I look at the election outcome Sunday, March 31st, and I was surprised maybe that despite his incumbency advantages, Erdogan's candidate had not even come close to İmamoğlu in Istanbul. But I wasn't more surprised that Erdogan's party had lost in the Anatolian hinterland. Places like Kütahya and Afyon, which are traditionally conservative Anatolian hinterland cities where Erdogan usually enjoyed comfortable margins of victory, were now lost to the opposition.
The CHP were the clear winners from this race. They won the most votes, but they also secured a significant boost in confidence. And the AKP didn't only lose to the CHP. They also lost out to the New Welfare Party, or YRP. The YRP are an Islamist party, and this was the first time that they had run in elections.
It's the third party of Turkey now. It came from nowhere. It feeds on a couple of things. It feeds on kind of hard Islamist sensitivities, a small base in Turkey that feels like AKP is no more representing them. And perhaps, you know, looking at urban versus rural divide, I think that was, the YRP was not a game changer in big cities. It did very weakly in large cities, in Istanbul under 2%, in most big cities, 1% to 2%. But it did tremendously well in the Anatolian hinterland. In central Turkey, it won a province, and in southeastern Turkey, in Urfa, a Kurdish Arab majority province, it also won that province. And it also made inroads in other areas. So I think the New Welfare Party is feeding on a populist kind of a trend. It's quite interesting.
For a first time out, the YRP victories of two provinces is an impressive achievement.
The New Welfare Party really managed to appeal to a lot of disgruntled AKP voters, particularly those who were very critical of Erdogan's stance vis-a-vis Israel, right? Erdogan has been an outspoken critic of Israel's policies, particularly after October 7th, and yet journalists reported that his family was involved in business with Israel, and in some instances saying that Turkey was even selling weapons and ammunition. So that, I think, appealed to a more ideologically oriented Islamist voters and managed to capture some votes from the ruling party.
Erdogan's handling of the war in Gaza was a key election issue for the YRP and its voters. At a campaign rally, the YRP's founder and leader, Fethullah Erbakan, addressed a crowd. He told them that Turkey meets 65% of Israel's steel needs. He went on to say that it produces weapons and ammunition with this raw steel material, continuing that those weapons are used to attack Palestine and Gaza, adding that Turkey is then responsible. If we were to put a face to the CHP victory, it would probably be the face of Ekrem İmamoğlu. He was decisively re-elected to serve a second term as the mayor of Istanbul. İmamoğlu beat his AKP opponent, handpicked by Erdogan, Murat Kurum, by 11.5%, over a million votes. When all the votes had been counted, İmamoğlu had secured over 50% of the vote. At this point, it's probably worth remembering what a big prize Istanbul is.
But Istanbul, Turkey's biggest city, its financial and commercial capital, city of 16 million inhabitants. Istanbul is bigger than most European countries demographically and economically. It's also significant because it accounts for 40% of Turkey's GDP, 30% of its tax base. It's a money-making machine, whether it is construction and zoning and urban development. The city generates tons of revenue, so controlling it means you control billions of dollars in income and revenue every year.
And what made Ekrem İmamoğlu so successful?
He's a very young, charismatic leader who can appeal to constituencies beyond the CHP's secularized, westernized base. So he is someone who can appeal to conservatives. He comes from a conservative background. So he is not your typical CHP candidate. And he can also appeal to the nationalists and Kurds. So he is someone who can appeal to large segments of the country. Istanbul is almost a microcosm of Turkey. You have it's the biggest city in the country, and you have various constituencies, key constituencies. So the fact that he managed to capture such a wide margin in a city that really reflects the demographic dynamics of the rest of the country is telling. It's telling us that he can appeal. He probably has appealed beyond Istanbul and across the country.
The CHP traditionally was considered the leftist party in the Turkish context. I think İmamoğlu's base is more blue and red, not just blue.
That's red and blue in the American political context.
And that's contrast to Erdogan's deeply red base. So he's built a bigger base compared to Erdogan. I think that's why he won. And CHP's gains in the Anatolian hinterland also suggest that maybe the party is tracking İmamoğlu's brand. It's building a red and blue base. And I think that's a big challenge for Erdogan, who has always won elections by polarizing on issues of culture and identity politics. Even more difficult for him, of course, to defeat a party that faces him and that has a red and blue coalition.
Back in the mid-1990s, there was another popular mayor of Istanbul who continued the upward trajectory and ended up becoming president. That mayor was Erdogan. Given the size that Istanbul represents, both in terms of population and economy, and his personal connection to the city, it is unsurprising that Erdogan wanted to win there.
I think that had Erdogan won Istanbul back from the opposition, even if he'd lost all the other key races, it would have been seen as a victory for him. But the opposite happened. İmamoğlu held onto Istanbul and he defeated Erdogan's candidate by a nearly 12-point margin, a landslide, very significant given Erdogan's incumbency advantages, his almost complete control of the media. So it was a humbling moment for Turkey's president.
For a while now, many in Turkey have looked at opposition candidate İmamoğlu to be the presumptive challenger to Erdogan at the next presidential election in 2028.
I think as someone who managed to beat the AKP's candidate three times, because remember in 2019 when he first won the elections, Erdogan asked for a rerun. He did not accept the election results. So in the rerun, İmamoğlu managed to secure another win, and this time with a wider margin. So this time it was almost the third time that he managed to beat his opponent from the ruling party. So that really places him in a great position to run in 2028.
Turkey's voters, like voters elsewhere these days, like to pick leaders that are charismatic, powerful, flamboyant, and maybe perhaps even someone who's not like the voters themselves. Kılıçdaroğlu made a case last year that he was a regular citizen. He broadcast YouTube videos from his middle-class kitchen with an air fryer. I think that was uninspiring to the voters.
Following his recent win, İmamoğlu is the presumptive name on the ticket for the next election. But with 4 years to go, others could emerge.
But this is my worry for the country, and that is there could be a power struggle between him and the leader of the CHP. And we could hear, 4 years, we won't be holding elections another 4 years, and 4 years is a long time. So another name could emerge. But right now, as I see things, İmamoğlu has become hugely popular, and he really built a wonderful track record for himself, not only as a mayor, but as someone who can actually appeal to different constituencies. That's a great track record. But on the other hand, you have a new CHP leader, Özgür Özel, who shortly after securing the chairmanship of the CHP, he proved himself to be a successful chairman, because the CHP became the most popular party under his watch.
İmamoğlu led the CHP to victory in Istanbul, but the party chairman, Özgür Özel, led the CHP to victory across Turkey. An electoral feat that cannot be ignored.
So that really gives his narrative that he can be the next challenger more credibility in 2028. I think these two figures, if they want to beat Erdogan at the ballot box in the next round, they really have to join forces. But I'm afraid there could be a power struggle between the two that could really weaken the party's appeal.
İmamoğlu looks likely, but 4 years is a long time in politics. Things could change. On the other side, it's Erdogan. But it shouldn't be Erdogan. According to the constitution, a president cannot serve more than 2 terms. This is Erdogan's 2nd term.
I think that he doesn't have the luxury of not running again, although he has the opportunity to retire, just because he has a successor problem. He doesn't have anyone who he could run and he could comfortably win elections. And I also think that when Erdogan says he's not going to run again, I really cannot believe him.
He certainly wants to run again. And the way to do that was to change the constitution. And I think his plan was to draft a new constitution and put that to referendum, which he had hoped to win comfortably. So that was his plan.
Changing the constitution through a referendum would be a path that Erdogan can take. It's a path he's taken before.
And I think one way Erdogan will try to undermine İmamoğlu's red and blue coalition is to perhaps come forward a polarizing constitutional debate. The debate would be on identity politics again. I can see him adding, for example, what is called a family values amendment to the new constitution, similar to what Hungarian Prime Minister Orban has done, defining marriage as exclusive between men and women. And of course, that would allow kind of the country's political landscape to be polarized again along the lines of right and left.
But right now, I think he needs to change his strategy, because after Sunday's vote, he understands that he's more vulnerable than he thinks. The opposition is a lot more stronger than he thinks. So he certainly wants to run again. I think he wants to be president for life.
A constitutional change to the number of times an individual can run, perhaps tied to a hot-button culture war issue through a referendum, is a way to another term. But following the recent election results, it's fraught with risk. Another option is if Parliament calls a snap election. It's an interpretation of the constitutional rules, an interpretation which would likely come up against stiff opposition. Even if Erdogan did find a way to run again, he would still have to win at the ballot box, which is far from guaranteed.
On the night of the election, in his election after his speech that he delivered after the elections, he said that he would stick with the orthodox economic policy that he had put in place. And that means really Turkey's economy is not going to recover overnight. People will feel the brunt of it. People will really struggle economically for a little longer. So while there is discontent, such wide discontent with the country's economy, he cannot really put a constitutional change to referendum. And I would say he cannot call for snap elections either in the short while. He just needs to let the new economy team do its work and fix the country's economic problems.
If the current economic policy continues, then it is thought that the road to recovery will take a couple of years, according to the country's finance ministers. With the next presidential election 4 years away, it could come in time. But the potential successes of these economic policies do also have to reach the streets and the pockets of Turkish voters, which could take a bit longer. Additionally, it would take even longer for the memories of the economic woes to be dispelled. This isn't the first time that Erdogan and his party have performed poorly at local elections. In 2019, the AKP secured the majority of the nationwide vote, but lost control of 9 provinces. What followed was a repressive crackdown. Numerous newly elected mayors were arrested and jailed, many of them being from the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party. In their place, state-appointed trustees were installed. With the recent election, we witnessed what looked like an attempt at a repeat of this in the eastern city of Van.
Electoral boards cancelled the outcome of the race in Van, a Kurdish-majority city, the only city in which a party had won all the districts. Turkey has 81 provinces, the only province where a party had won all districts. So unique victory for pro-Kurdish liberal Dem Party. And the board canceled the outcome, although the Dem Party candidate had won with a wide margin, and decided to recognize the runner-up AKP candidate. Shocking.
The pro-Kurdish candidate got over 50% of the vote, and almost double that of the AKP candidate.
What happened last time with the board canceling outcome of elections and sacking pro-Kurdish mayors did not go through this time.
This time, the people of Van took to the streets to express their anger at the decision.
This time he faced something that he hadn't before, and that was large-scale protests. And those protests were backed by the main opposition party, CHP. So that made the difference. And that really forced Erdogan to back down. All these things tell me that if Erdogan tries to, let's say, sideline his most popular opponents like İmamoğlu with a court case, that he's going to pay a steep political, electoral political price for that.
Another crackdown is an option for Erdogan. But like a constitutional referendum or a snap election, it's a risk, which has all the potential to backfire. As Erdogan has increasingly centralized power around himself and become the strongman leader that we know today, observers have predicted the end of Turkish democracy.
Well, let's not call it Turkish democracy. The regime that we have in Turkey at the moment is not a democracy. Political scientists call it a competitive authoritarian regime. It's authoritarian because the incumbent, in this case Erdogan, turns the playing field so much in his favor that the opposition's prospects, electoral prospects are dim. But it's competitive because an opposition victory at the ballot box is not impossible. And it's also competitive because still many people, despite all the autocratic steps that Erdogan has taken, still a majority of the country believes in the electoral process. So that's what makes Turkey's authoritarian regime competitive.
Okay, not a democracy, but a competitive authoritarian regime. Following the recent vote, could we say that the competition is healthy? Sona Çaptay.
I would say Turkey is a country where democratic elections have been held for so long and the tradition is so deep that although the race is not fair until the day of the race, I think the day of the race, it does become a free vote, and free vote is what matters. And I think ultimately Turkey's citizens therefore were able to upset Erdogan. So the vote remains free, and I think that's quite a significant takeaway. It's about democratic resilience. Turkey's citizens have been voting in free and fair elections since 1950, which is longer than the citizens of Spain have been doing the same since 1970s, the fall of Franco. So that tells you something about democratic memory and resilience, of course.
Final words to Gonal Tol.
So there are still non-governmental organizations, there are still civil society organizations that mobilize people to go out to vote. You have real opposition parties that have strong institutions that have strong local branches. They go out there, the candidates campaign, they are denied a major, they are denied airtime. Erdogan dominates the media, uses state resources, and yet they still try to get their message across. So that's why I do not want to say that Turkish democracy is resilient, because Turkey is not a democracy, but I would like to say that the recent election results suggest Turkey's pro-democracy forces are resilient.
This episode of The New Arab Voice was written and produced by me, Hugo Goodridge. Our theme music was by Omar El Phil. The New Arab Voice will be back next week. Until then, you can find all our previous episodes on all major podcast platforms. Our podcast roundup of the biggest stories, The New Arab Weekly, will be out with a new episode on Friday. Don't forget to subscribe to get notified for when a new episode drops. You can find a link in the show notes. You can also check us out on social media at TNA Podcast for additional content. And you can email us, podcast@newarab.com. We also have a weekly newsletter which you can sign up for. Find the link in the show notes. You can subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And you can also rate and review, which helps us spread the word. Don't forget to follow The New Arab on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram for all the latest news, analysis and opinion from the region.